Environment, Natural Resources is open. We are going to go in this order today. We're going to start with 2620 and then take House Bill 2051. And then we will just go in order starting from the top of the list with 2114 all the way through. So with that, we will start with a public hearing on House Bill 2620. Representative Holvey, why don't you come up? Sue, why don't you give us the rundown?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2620A provides that public improvement contracts for construction or for certain reconstruction or major renovation of public buildings are considered to contain an amount equal to at least 1.5% of the total contract price for inclusion of appropriate solar technology. Provides for some exceptions, requires the State Department of Energy to develop forms and report to the Legislative Assembly in 2009 and 2011 on the use of solar energy technology in construction, reconstruction, or major renovation of public buildings.
Thank you, Sue. Mr. Graney, welcome to you, too. Representative, glad to have you here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's good to be here. I appreciate you letting me have Mr. Greeny from the Department of Energy up here with me as well. For the record, Paul Holvey, State Representative from District 8. I bring you House Bill 2620. I'm providing you written testimony, which I won't read to you because it always annoys me when people do that. So I just wanted to kind of run through the basis of this bill is basically to give a shot in the arm to the solar industry in the state of Oregon, as well as making our buildings more energy diverse and energy efficient as well, and hopefully saving the taxpayers some dollars down the road. We had a lot of testimony on the other side of the building about solar energy and, you know, all the good aspects of it, but I'm not going to get into all of that. I just kind of want to walk through what this bill does. It basically requires 1.5% of the contract price be set aside for solar technology, being specifically solar electric, solar thermal, and passive solar. And if the passive solar achieves a reduction in energy usage of at least 20%, those are the basic three areas that this bill looks at. It also is somewhat permissive in that a contracting agency can make its own determination whether it's appropriate or not to use solar technology on a particular building. If in fact they determine that it's not appropriate and this is not a cost-effective analysis, they could use that if they so chose to determine whether it was appropriate or not. But I wanted it to be more permissive than making them go through an expensive analysis of every building that comes around. But if in fact they determine that it's not appropriate, they're not required to spend that 1.5%, but they are required to roll that 1.5% over to a future building. And that's only applicable if they're using state funds. And the Department of Energy is going to be coming up with a form that they make this determination of whether it's appropriate or not so that they can turn it, so the Department of Energy can access that form to collect data essentially on how we're doing with implementing solar technologies in public buildings. It's a pretty simple concept, but maybe not quite as simple as some would think. I've been working on this for probably 3 years, trying to get this tuned up to a point where we didn't have a lot of objections about the implementation of this bill. I'd turn it over to Mike Graney to answer any specific questions you have about solar technologies, or if you have any further questions of me on this concept, maybe I can answer them for you.
All right, why don't we start with Mr. Graney first.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Mike Graney, Director of the Department of Energy. We support House Bill 2620. The bill does require the investments to be cost-effective, and we think that working with buildings at the design stage, there's ample opportunity to build in cost-effective solar and different technologies. We also think that, as Representative Holvey has drafted the bill and written it up, that it'll be workable, that it won't impose added cost on our department in terms of being able to develop rules and standards and guidelines for state agencies and applicable other governments that receive state funds, so it'd be easy for them to work with us on. And I think this would be a good complement to the, on the state level, to the work that the state agencies are doing to reduce their energy consumption and to acquire Chief Governor's targets of 100% of state agency load of renewable energy by the year 2010. So I think this is a good bill with lots of safeguards in terms of workability and flexibility on rulemaking to make this work.
All right, very good.
Mr. Chair, may I just add that I also have -4 amendments that we would prefer to be adopted into this bill that hopefully you have copies of, that have worked through an issue that was brought to us by the special districts about defining exactly what a public building is in regards to this bill. Do you not have -4 amendments?
Who's making sure we do? You have them?
Yeah, we've got them.
Okay. I do have extras if you need some.
Nope.
And we just wanted to do that because we wanted to make sure that we weren't talking about structures that contain, you know, pumps and some other types of structures that just really, really didn't fit this concept, I guess. And we're giving the rulemaking authority as well to the Department of Energy to help make that determination of what that public building is with the guidelines we've laid out here.
Okay, committee questions? Senator Byrd?
Thank you. Page 2, lines 8 and 9, we're talking about only if state funds are directly or indirectly used. So that includes school districts and building of schools.
It would, in fact, if they are using state funds.
I guess that's getting to my point. Are you considering the construction of schools using state funds directly or indirectly?
You want to take a shot at that?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Beyer, it depends on how the school is raising their money. Typically, for construction of a new school, the school district often has a local levy that's not considered state money. We do actually work with the local schools anyway to try to, on their design, try to maximize both not only renewable resources but cost-effective energy efficiency at the design phase too, because that's much more cost-effective. But I think that's the distinction, that would not be considered state money. That would be considered local funds.
So follow-up, Mr. Chair, is there a threshold? Because, for instance, let's say the school uses operating funds to design the building and then passes a bond to build the building.
Well, I guess it would be my intent that that's not actually part of the construction of the school. If it was part of the contract, I suppose, to build the school, perhaps it would be, but usually the design contract is done separately with an architect. But if it's done with a design build contractor, it very well could apply here. That would be my take on it.
What was the purpose of focusing on solar as opposed to some other type of source?
Well, a lot of people have asked that question. This was aimed strictly at the solar industry, recognizing that we have other kinds of industry that provides diversity to our grid, like wind power and those sorts of things. One of the big pieces of this was really to try to give a shot and an arm to our solar industry and to try to attract a manufacturer of photovoltaics in this state as being an offshoot of one of the clusters that's identified by the Economic Development Department in Silicon Chips to be exact, and we had testimony from Bob Griepine on the other side of this building encouraging us to go forward with this, and we found out after this bill was introduced that we did land a Solar World building a new factory in the Hillsborough area, which he spoke to, and they're very supportive of this bill, obviously. This was just meant as an economic driver for the solar industry in the state of Oregon. I feel there's a great potential in this state to become a leader in solar technology, and that's why the focus was strictly on solar technology in this bill.
Anything else, committee? Okay, thank you both very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Jeff Bissonette and Amanda Rich. Yeah, go right ahead. Sorry.
That's okay. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jeff Bissonette, representing the Fair and Clean Energy Coalition, statewide collaboration of consumer groups, environmental organizations, clean energy businesses, faith groups, and a variety of other interests focused around energy issues. Excuse me. One of the members of our coalition is the Oregon Solar Energy Industries Association, who asked me to say a few words on this this bill, since their director, John Miller, unfortunately couldn't be here, and they didn't have another representative that could come today. The Solar Energy Industry Association is very much in support of the bill, and to pursue the chair's question about why solar as opposed to other technologies. Solar is a developed technology that can be very well adapted to standalone buildings much better than other technologies. They are working on some small wind turbines and that sort of thing, but they're still kind of in the prototypical phase. But solar is a technology that can be well adapted across the state. Even in our cloudiest areas, we have more sun than in the bulk of the country of Germany, which is sort of the world leader in solar technology. And so it's widely applicable and can be adapted, and the flexibility of the bill also enables not only to adapt active technology, i.e. actually generating electricity, but also passive design issues in terms of placement of the building, daylighting, etc. And so, again, as long as that passive design can achieve 20% energy reduction, it can be used to meet the requirements of this bill. But the solar industry is very excited about the possibilities. It's very important to think about these sorts of issues in the earliest of the design phases. And so it is the hope that this bill will kind of help in that thinking and to put these issues kind of on the table from the outset, and that will be very advantageous. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Okay. Ms. Rich, why don't we go to you first?
Sure. Senator Avakian and members of the committee, my name is Amanda Rich, and I'm here today representing the Special Districts Association of Oregon, and here today in support of the Dash 4 amendments that you have before you. We came to the table on this bill after my water and wastewater utilities came to me and said, you know, we receive quite a bit of state funds through the Special Public Works Fund, Water Wastewater Revolving Loan Fund, things that are run through economic development. And they said, frequently we build structures to house our pumps, and we might build, you know, four or five to house pumps along the system. And, you know, they're 50 by 50 structures. The main energy use that is used in them is just to power the pump. And, you know, somebody might need to turn on a light switch to go in and check the pumps, but that's about it. They said, are we going to have to put solar panels on those? I said, well, let me talk to the folks about this. And I want to thank Representative Holvey and Jeff for working with us on these amendments. I think that putting the discretion in the hands of Department of Energy is a great way to be able to kind of get at some of these specific structures that really don't fit the concept, as Representative Holvey mentioned. So we appreciate Representative Holvey's work on this, and would support or ask for your support of the Dash 4 amendments.
Okay. Senator Beyer.
Thank you. Just curious to get to this issue of the reduction of 20% energy usage. How are they going to know if, when they're designing the building, you know, and they want to put in some passive solar, but it says it will achieve a reduction of energy uses of at least 20%.
Mm-hmm.
How are they going to be able to know that so they can know if they've followed the law?
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, there are energy models that are used that, you know, can make those predictions, and that is, it's the same standard that the state uses to grant a residential energy tax credit for passive, and so I would guess they would use the same the same model to do those projections. Department of Energy might be able to answer that in sort of the more specific engineering way, but the best answer is that there are the models that can project those savings and the designs, and there are designs that have been shown to achieve those savings, and so they'd again be using the same models and the same evaluation techniques as they do to decide whether or not to grant a residential energy tax credit.
Is that it?
Yep.
All right. Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Committee's going to stand at ease for just a minute while we round up a committee member.
I'll do it.
Sorry, I need to break in.
Okay. Yeah.
Back on, and I'm going to close the public hearing on 2620 and open a work session on 2620. If I could have A motion on the dash fours.
Mr. Shell, would you entertain a motion to move the dash four amendments?
How could I resist? The Southern gentleman, Senator Atkinson, moves the dash four amendments into 2620. Is there any discussion?
Just be glad that he actually lives in the southern part of the state, or I'd take offense to it.
Fair enough. Any objections? Seeing none, the dash fours are adopted, and a motion on the bill.
Why don't we move the entire bill to the floor, the due pass recommendation?
Thank you. Amended. As amended.
As amended.
As amended, Senator Atkinson moves 2620 as amended to the fourth due pass recommendation. Discussion?
Be an O, please.
Objections?
One.
Senator Byer noted, and with that, so ordered. And Senator Atkinson, you want to carry this one? Or would you rather have
I would be delighted to right. carry that bill.
Okay, you've got that. With that, I'll close the work session on 2620. And I had said we're going to do 2051 next, but I am going to instead move to 3013.
Okay.
All right, we'll open a public hearing on House Bill 3013. Matt, could you bring me up all the sheets? There we go.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3013 prohibits annexation during incorporation proceedings until petition is rejected by county court or voters reject incorporation at election. And for the record, there is a letter of support of House Bill 3013 from Oregon Communities for a Voice in Annexation.
All right, Don Phillips, and I don't see Senator George in the room. He's not going to make it. All right, you want to bring up anybody you want to bring up?
Good afternoon, Senators. For the record, Don Phillips, Chief of Staff for State Representative Jerry Crummell, House District 26. Wilsonville, Sherwood, Gaston, and the lovely almost town of Bull Mountain. Briefly, I want to introduce Lisa Hamilton Trike, who's been a very active community activist up on Bull Mountain and has been working with Representative Crummell over the last 4 years on some of the annexation issues that have been going on. And we worked in the interim between last session and this one on this issue, and I'm going to let her expand on it a little bit. But we got quite a bit of support from the annexation work group that Representative Roblin and Representative Boquist, Representative Clem and Edwards put together over the last couple of months, and worked with all the parties, and then we were able to get it off the House. I think it was unanimous, wasn't it?
Close enough.
Okay.
Yeah, four opposed, I think.
So thank you for your indulgence today. I will let Lisa take it from here and stick around if you have any questions.
Good afternoon, Senator Avakian, members of the committee. Don Phillips mentioned I'm Lisa Hamilton Trike. I do reside in the unincorporated area of Bull Mountain. I was fortunate to have served on the Senate Bill 887 work group in 2006 and then on the 2007 work group just recently. I was one of the three chief petitioners for the incorporation of the city of Bull Mountain. Unfortunately, the measure failed to pass by a narrow margin of 2%. We fell 154 votes short. It was a costly and time-intensive grassroots effort. It was funded 100% by the people who live on Bull Mountain in the unincorporated area, and we will be paying those bills off for quite a long time. It was through personal loans and fundraisers and garage sales and what have you, and we do have obligations that we still have to satisfy. It's a pretty involved process in getting a petition on a ballot for incorporation. I won't belabor all the details. I think you just received a five-page letter with some maps attached that I prepared for you, and that explains a little bit the process that we went through to get to the point where we went before the Washington County Board of Commissioners, and they scheduled four public hearings. And I guess the nuts and bolts of this is that we went through this lengthy, extensive process to prepare the most logical boundary, and did the economic feasibility study to determine the proposed operating tax rate limit. And shortly after this process went before the county, the city of Tigard requested some changes to the boundary, and it involved ultimately about 40 some acres, originally about 60. It ended up about 40. And if I could direct your attention to the last page of that packet that I handed to you, and you'll see the darkened area is the area that the city of Tigard proposed to pull out of the boundary that had been proposed for incorporation. The colored area is the area that was proposed as the new city. The black area that kind of digs into that is the area that the city of Tigard wanted to remove. Washington County went through their public hearing process and ultimately in the end decided that they did not want to have that area removed. They pulled out an area that was outside the urban growth boundary and added 5 acres from another area, and there was no opposition to that. So they did deny. They heard Tigard's concerns, and ultimately they decided against pulling that area out. Right before their final decision was made, the city of Tigard began to move forward with annexation proceedings. And in the end, it cost those of us who were working on this process a lot of money to try to preserve the integrity of that boundary. It wasn't resolved before the election. Had the incorporation happened, the city would have then had to go through the proper channels to be able to get that resolved. And so I think it was a really unnecessary and really unfortunate thing that happened. And House Bill 3013 can prevent this from happening again. And no doubt unincorporated areas throughout Oregon will continue to petition for incorporation as they are attempting to meet the stated goals and policies of the state of Oregon, of Oregon's counties and Oregon cities, the existing Oregon cities. The 2007 Oregon legislature has an opportunity to end last-minute, expensive, contentious annexation battles and to still provide cities with a legitimate opportunity to state their case in incorporation hearings. If the reasons for altering a proposed boundary are sound, a county can honor their request. And I ask that you please move House Bill 3013 forward and end the waste. Thank you for your time. If you have questions, I'm happy to
answer.
Questions,
committee? Okay. Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Linda Ludwig.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Linda Ludwig, League of Oregon Cities. My comments are going to be very brief. The League doesn't have an official position on this bill. However, having done a considerable amount of research on annexation both in this state and throughout the nation, I would just say to you today that what we have here, the meat and potatoes of this bill, that you can't move forward with an annexation proceeding if an incorporation petition has been filed. We see that in many, many other states. And as a matter of policy, it probably makes a lot of good sense when you remove it out of the microscope of the Tigard Bull Mountain area and look at it on a statewide impact basis.
Good. Very good. Thank you very much. All right, and that is it for folks wanting to testify on 3013. So I will close the public hearing on 3013 and open a work session on 3013. If I could have a motion.
Mr. Chair.
Senator.
I move House Bill 3013 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you, Senator Fezanski, moving 3013 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? And any objections? And seeing them so ordered, and I will carry 3013. With that, we will close the work session on House Bill 3013, and we will open a public hearing on House Bill 2713.
Mm.
And Sue, while you're looking that up, Sarah Myers and Dan
Lynn Scheid, if you want to come on up.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2713A authorizes utility easements for private utility infrastructure, prohibits the placement of public or private utility easements within 1 foot of a survey monument on a subdivision or partition plat, modifies the definition of partition land to divide land to create no more than 3 parcels of land within a calendar year.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Sarah Myers representing the Professional Land Surveyors of Oregon. Here today in support, of course, of House Bill 2713, and thank you for taking the time to hear it today. As the staff summarized, the bill corrects a statutory problem, as we perceive it, to allow landowners with multiple units of land to create one parcel through the petitioning process, and therefore avoiding a current requirement of an expensive and time-consuming replatting process. Secondly, the bill again adds the term private with respect to utility infrastructure placement so that now where the statute only recognizes public utilities, it will now both recognize private as well as public utilities. And finally, the bill adds language to establish that one-foot buffer around a monument pin so as noted on a survey, subdivision, or partition plat. There has been no opposition to the bill to date. Cities and counties worked with us on this particular piece of legislation, and so we do encourage and your favorable support as well. Thank you.
Committee? Okay. Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Senator Vakian, I'm not going to add anything to her. She did an excellent job. Dan Lynch, Chair of PLSL. Thank
Very
you.
Good.
Senator
Byer.
Sarah, I had asked you to check with the private utility providers, specifically the manufactured homeowners. Any problems?
Chair Avakian, Senator Byer, no. I did speak with Mr. Brenneman, and he did indicate that he had no problems with that bill.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you both very much. With that, we'll close the public hearing on 2713. Open the work session on 2713.
Mr. Chair, may I move Senate House Bill 2713, this little teeny weeny bill, off to the floor of the House, of the Senate, I mean, with a due pass for a recommendation?
Yep, that would be the Senate. And yes, you may. Thank you, Senator Atkinson, for moving 2713 to the Senate floor with due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objections? Seeing none, so ordered. And yes, Senator Atkinson, you may carry the bill. And with that, let's move close the work session. Did I do that on 2713? Let's open a public hearing on HJM 12. Bill Cluding and Joe Misek, why don't you come up while Sue fills us in?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, HJM 12 urges Congress to pass legislation to allow the Forest Service of the United States and the Bureau of Land Management to enter into 15-year contracts for the removal of biomass from federal forests in Oregon in order to provide fuel for cogeneration plants.
Thank you, Chair. Logging in committee. Yeah.
Senator, before you get started, Mr. Kling, Senator Atkinson makes a very good point here. Every one of us is a co-sponsor of the bill. We're ready to move it. So please feel free to give us a summary, but we're ready to go as soon as you're done.
The quickest summary I can come up is our bill record. Bill setting for the record, Cartman Industrial Council. I've talked to all you folks. Our forests are in a crisis. Our forest managers are crying for help. They're calling their own forests in a crisis, and I urge this bill to be passed. And I'll let Joel.
Very good. Thank you. Chair Avakian and members of the committee, for the record, Joe Misek, policy analyst with the Department of Forestry. The Department of Forestry supports HJM 12. It's consistent with Board of Forestry forest management policies under the forestry program for Oregon, and with the recommendations that were found from the Oregon Forest Biomass Work Group. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions? Seeing none, thank you both very much. We'll close the public hearing on HJM 12. Open a work session on HJM 12. If I could have a motion, please.
Mr. Chair, I move HJM 12 to the floor to do adopt recommendation.
Thank you, Senator Atkinson, for moving HJM 12 to the floor with a do adopt recommendation. Is there any discussion?
May I request the carrier?
You actually
mean would all the sponsors carry the bill?
Certainly, we'll all share. No, and any objections? Seeing none, so ordered. And you can lead the charge, Senator Beyer, by carrying HJM 12. Thank you very much. And I will open, close the work session on HJM 12. Open a public. We have it just set for a work session, which is actually good. Open a work session on House Bill 2051. And even though we're going straight to a work session, Sue, maybe you could just remind the committee.
Yes, I will. House Bill 2051A requires Metro to complete first inventory, determination, and analysis of housing capacity and need within the urban growth boundary by December 31st, 2009. This allows a two-year extension from the current due date on or after December 1st, 2007.
All right. Thank you, Sue. I know we have an amendment. Senator Beyer, you would like to present your amendment?
Yes, I'd like to move the -A6 amendment into House Bill 2051. I'd like to move the -A6 amendment into House Bill 2051. Excuse me.
Thank you. Senator moves the dash, I'm sorry, the
A6.
-A6 amendment in a 2051 discussion.
Mr. Chair, this amendment, I hope everyone has it. Should have been handed out by the committee staff. Thank you. Simply says that the analysis required in subsection 1 of the section must include a demonstration of compliance with requirements of statewide land use planning goal relating to stable and healthy economies, also known as Goal 9. Mr. Chair, so it would just require Metro to follow that goal in this planning process. And if I could ask Mr. Tucker to come forward, I'd like to have him speak to the amendment if he could. But
Mr. Tucker, would you like to come up to the table, please?
Chair, members of the committee, Randy Tucker, Metro Legislative Affairs Manager. I got wind.
Do you have a copy of the amendment?
Yes, we do. I saw it this morning, and so I'm not any expert on Goal 9. I called Dick Benner, who is one of our senior attorneys. Is that right? Senior deputy attorney?
Senior.
And asked him to come and explain what this would mean to the committee, if that's with your leave.
Senator Beyer, up to you.
Thank you. Yes, please.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Dick Benner, on the legal staff at Metro. The effect of the amendment would be to make Metro subject to Goal 9. Goal 9 is the economy of the state goal. It is not currently applicable to Metro. And the reason for that, going back historically, when the goal was written and then when you amended the statute to mirror the goal, was that the nitty-gritty work of Goal 9 is done by cities and counties who allocate land among employment uses such as office uses and retail commercial uses and industrial uses. And that was seen as an inappropriate role for the regional government that was more of a city and county role. And let me give you an example. When you think about the land use side of economic development, probably, well, certainly the first part of it, but the most important part of it, is making sure that there's an adequate land base for economic development. And regionally, that is Metro's responsibility. It's Metro's responsibility under Goal 14, which is the urbanization goal, because we're the ones, every 5 years, who determine whether there's enough land inside the boundary for all uses, including employment uses. And if there isn't, we add land. That's what we're supposed to do, and that's under Goal 14. Once the land comes in, then cities and counties are the ones who, generally speaking, take it from there. There was a discussion about amending Goal 9 to make it applicable to Metro about 5 years ago. And during the discussion, these very same issues that sort of the division of labor, if you will, that I was just describing was part of the discussion. What should be the role of the regional government in economic development? And I can tell you, during that discussion, cities and counties were not anxious to get Metro in the role that they now play in economic development. And I'll give you a couple of practical examples. If you know the Metro area, the Alcoa aluminum property that is at the east end of the region, close to the river, served by the rail, by rail, and by 84, right up against city of Troutdale. We want to make sure that there's an adequate land base for all the kinds of industrial and commercial uses that we see coming in the next 20 years. But Troutdale wants to make sure that it's in the position of determining what happens on that property. And if you ask them, if you ask cities and counties in the region, would you like Metro to be making those decisions? I think they would tell you that they do not. So if Goal 9 applies to us, we would have to do all of the things that Goal 9 says instead of the allocation of authority we have now between Goal 9 and Goal 14. So it's getting Metro into that business is not something to undertake lightly, and you certainly ought to be talking to the cities and counties of the region. I think what they would tell you is, we want to keep Metro some distance away from this. I know there are people at Metro who would like to get into economic development, but I suspect they would encounter a good bit of resistance from the cities and counties.
Very good. Senator Byer, any other questions?
No, Mr. Chair.
All right. Committee, are there any other questions of these two? All right. Well, thank you both.
Actually, I do on a different topic.
Go ahead. Don't go too far afield because we've only got 10 minutes of one more bill to hear.
Sure. The Stafford mess is, and we're talking about two bills here, companion, a lot of history, a lot of upset people on a whole variety of things. Has it been worked out?
It has been, Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
What has been the resolution?
The resolution, actually, the Stafford, Kelsey is here who represents concerned citizens of Stafford, but they also distributed a letter to all of you on this bill, should be in your files, I would hope, that I have back on my seat that I could... the resolution is that, if I may speak for them, and obviously I don't...
Just go ahead and do it.
Thank you.
Spit it out. Spit it out, Randy.
They have agreed to support House Bill 2051 with no amendments, and we are working with, you know, Metro is working with them to examine the possibility of a code amendment to our code that might provide them an opportunity to apply for UGB expansions in advance of the next time that we would normally be doing the analysis if House Bill 2051 were to pass. They've agreed, and it's in their letter, that there's no quid pro quo. There's no understanding that that amendment is guaranteed to pass at Metro, nor that if it were to pass, that any particular land would be brought into the urban growth boundary, but they'll be participating in that process, and we've all agreed to work together in good faith on that.
What assurances does this policymaking body have that that will be taken care of as soon as sine die happens?
The ordinance is planned to be first read at Metro. Assurances, I can only give you my own word, but the ordinance is planned to be first read at Metro on May 31st. There's a 45-day notification period that Dick could speak to if necessary, where we have to notify LCDC, and the current schedule is to take that amendment up in July after that period has ended.
Is there an ongoing work group between those residents and Metro?
Mr. Chair, Senator Atkinson, I'm not sure I would say there's an ongoing work group. There have been numerous conversations over the last couple of weeks, and that group was satisfied that...
not all of that group, because my phone still rings. So if there's is there going to be some kind of ongoing conversation with the group that Martin Associates represents and Mike Stewart and his group that he represents, his relationship to this problem?
My understanding is that the answer is yes, but most of those conversations have been taking place with my colleagues it at Metro and not with me. What I have is the letter that they supplied. I don't know that it constitutes a formal work group, Senator, but it does constitute a good faith effort on both sides to.
We're building a public record here, Mr. Tucker.
Thank you.
What I'm talking about. Okay. Thank you.
I can only speak to what I know.
Okay. Thank you both very much. Appreciate you being here. We do have a motion on the amendment before us. Senator Beyer, I do want to say that I thank you for bringing the amendment forward. We're done with you two.
Thank you. Go back.
Okay. We had 12 or 14, I think, bills to maybe a dozen or so that all dealt with modifying land around the urban growth boundary in one way or another. These two metro bills are two of the only ones that we really spent any time on. But with your motion, regardless of what happens with the V, it raises what I think is a very, very valid concern about what the state's policy is going to be on a statewide basis with regard to lands that are adjacent to urban growth boundaries. And that's a discussion that I hope really continues in earnest throughout the interim.
Mr. Chair, I withdraw my motion.
All right. Thank you, Senator Beyer. The motion is withdrawn, and if I could have a motion on the bill itself.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move 2051 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you, Senator Bates, for moving 2051 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion?
10 seconds. I want to thank the parties involved in this for sitting down, working something out, and getting a consensus. We will be back in February, so we want that consensus to hold up just as has been outlined by Senator Atkinson. I expect it will be. I think all parties have done this in good faith, and that the net result is going to be good for Metro and for the city. Thank you.
All right. Any objections?
Mr. Chair, yes.
Senator Beyer noted. And with that so ordered, Senator Bates, would you carry the bill, please?
I'll be glad to. Thank you.
And I will close the work session on 2051, open a public hearing on House Bill 3025A, and while Sue is reading that, if John Chandler, Ken Sherman, and Linda Ludwig could all come up. And if you could, please keep your testimony extremely brief, since we need to be out of here in 6 minutes.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3025A modifies the definition of land use decision and limited land use decision to exclude decisions of local government to approve or withhold approval of a final subdivision of a partition plat or that determines whether a final subdivision of a partition plat substantially conforms to tentative subdivision or partition plan. Declares an emergency effective on passage.
All right.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. John Chandler, Oregon Home Builders Association, here on House Bill 3205. Just the background noise on this very briefly. Last session, this legislature passed a bill to address the Hammer case, Hammer versus Clackamas County. In the Hammer case, the Court of Appeals found something that none of us who practice in this area of law had ever seen before, which was a issue regarding the signature of the surveyor on a final subdivision plat and how that might trigger the requirement for notice and an opportunity for a hearing. We closed that loophole last session, thanks to this body's work. After session, in the annual report of the real estate and land use section of the Oregon State Bar, a land use attorney spotted another set of loopholes and said, well, they closed this one, they didn't close these, and so this bill in front of you is an attempt to further staple shut the loopholes and put the law back to where all of us who practice in this area thought it was since the early 1970s. It passed the House unanimously on a consent calendar coming out of committee over there. Good bill should pass. I will defer now to Mr. Ken Sherman from the Oregon Bankers Association for a more substantive explanation of what the bill does, and I'll be glad to take questions at the end.
Well, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Ken Sherman. I've submitted testimony. I'm counsel for the Oregon Bankers. You might wonder why we're here on a bill dealing with land use, and I'll get to that in a minute. To understand this bill, you need to think about the process by which a subdivision is approved. There's an application filed.
Mr. Sherman?
Yes.
Before you launch into the Hammer decision, I'm going to give you 2 minutes.
Okay. Thank you.
So get to the crux of the matter as quickly as you can.
Another Hammer decision?
No, something.
Thank you.
I'm very glad you're here.
Thank you. The crux of the matter is, Mr. Chairman, that you go through this whole land use process, complete with hearings sometimes that go on for months, and then you get your decision, you get a preliminary plat approval, you go in and you spend sometimes hundreds of thousands of dollars making the improvements pursuant to the preliminary approval. You then come back to get your final approval, to sign off on the checklist. The Hammer decision said that decision, that final approval is an appealable event, and that's what we're trying to reverse here. At risk for the property owner and for the lending institution is the prospect of a whole another round of appeals on top of that which you've already been through. So we're simply trying to, as Mr. Chandler said, restore the law to what it has been since the 70s. One of our primary interests in this bill is the impact that this decision could have on the financeability of low-income housing. And that's the area that we think is going to take the first hit if we don't straighten this out. So with that, I'll stop and answer any questions.
Very good. Ms. Ludwig?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Linda Ludwig, League of Oregon Cities. Good bill should pass. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions, committee? Seeing none, I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3205A and open a work session on 3205A.
Oh, it's
3205A. 30. 32. Oh, look at that.
30.
3025. It's 3025A.
I would move to 3025A to do pass recommendation.
Thank you, Senator Atkinson, for moving 3025A to the floor for due pass recommendation. Any discussion?
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Beyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just appreciate either recording me as a no or doing a roll call vote, one or the other.
We'll just do it by objection, and yours is noted.
I'll object also.
And Senator Atkinson's is noted. Any others? And seeing none, so ordered. Could I have a carrier? Who would like this one?
I'll do that.
Thank you, Senator Pozanski. Carries. Yeah. Close the work session on 3025A, and we are adjourned.
And
thank you, committee.
Mr. Chair and committee, serving notice of the minority report.
Notice of minority report.
On which one?
3025.
Really? Yeah.